Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
From the blackest corners of your mind, they call, pulling you deep into shadow, twisting your senses, keeping you from sleep. It's time to face your darkest fears. This is Tales to Terrify.
Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. For those of you who have the distinct pleasure of not knowing who I am, you can just refer to me as Andrew Gibson. I've been working behind the scenes here at Tales to Terrify for a couple years now as both a narrator and audio editor. I'm going to keep things short and sweet today, electing to delve into today's fiction right after a quick thank you to a new patron. Sophia O., thank you, and welcome to the fold. Our first story for the evening comes from Eris Young. Eris Young is a queer, transgender writer of speculative fiction. Their work has appeared in publications such as Escape Pod, Fusion Fragment, and the immigrant sci-fi short stories anthology From Flame Trees Press, and was longlisted for the Cheshire Novel Prize in 2023. They are the fiction editor at British Fantasy Awards shortlisted magazine Shoreline of Infinity. Children of the Night, join me for Eris Young's Idomeneja, or The Death Mask, first published on Pseudopod, episode 831.
The whole ride back to the village, I hold you steady in the back of the pickup, praying the straps hold, the wood isn't rotted, and that you won't be tumbled into dust before I even get you out. Every dip, every hill crested, my heart jumps into my mouth. Sweating, I look eastward, watching for the light creeping back into the sky. It's morning by the time I get you back into the house. Relief of a cool entryway, of knowing you're safe in the garage below the tiles under my feet. Birdsong comes in through an open window somewhere. I wash the dust off of my skin and it pools red around the drain. I crawl into my sleeping bag for a few hours, then sit on the balcony to watch the sun move. It dips behind the ridge to the west, but I wait, chewing my cuticles, for true sunset. When it is well past the horizon, when it is safe, I go downstairs. Now that I have you, I don't feel rushed. The house, paid up for a month, has olive groves all around. It sits in a construction site. The builders paid to go away. In the village near the dig site, they are used to archaeologists, used to not asking questions when something needs to disappear. This is not even the first time Christos has been asked to drive to the site after dark. I will find out later that the fee he charged me is the standard one. The wood is rotted on top. Some water has pooled on it at some point in the last 3,000 years. It splinters blackly as I pry the lid open, heart pounding. Your mask is delicate, rumpled. I hold it under the bare bulb to see the inscriptions, and it nearly floats out of my hands. Later, I will look at it again, trying to find the ghost of your features there, but the design is too stylized. It might as well have been my own face beaten into the metal. I take a photo with flash and hear you rustle, no louder than a scrap of paper falling to the floor. We are the only ones here, so I know it is you. The idea that you might be so keen to meet me makes me want to cry. I've been putting off looking at you. Don't think it's because I'm afraid to see your face. It's been 10 years since I found out about you. 6 since I started planning. I knew from the first second what I would find in your sarcophagus. You are beautiful. The fruit of so much labor, I can finally taste. I lean over to kiss you on what remains of your teeth, careful not to disturb your jaw. You kick or twitch again. I lick your dust off my lips and whisper, Idomenea. You don't move, but I feel you respond to your name. Suddenly, I understand. You have been waiting for me much longer than I've been waiting for you. So I don't flinch or hesitate at all. Are you proud of me? The first few drops fall onto your face, sending up little puffs of brown dust, but then they start to absorb. I try and get as many as I can into your mouth until they start leaking out again through a hole in your jaw or neck. I grow dizzy. We are both shaking like leaves. I can still hear you rustling as I climb the stairs into the house, lock the door behind me. You drink from me every night, like a baby bird, a calf. Your fingers grow softer, your grip stronger. Your mouth bruises the skin of my inner arm. It hurts. I know it hurts, my love. Your regrowing muscle, bright new teeth burrowing their way out of your skull. Your crushed pelvis reassembling itself. I'm sharing the pain with you, savoring it, as you savor me. I'm hungry all the time, too. As if I was nursing you or growing you in my womb. I eat peanut butter from the jar, handfuls of fried whitebait, meat rare and red. I take iron supplements and still wake up each evening, ready to go to your side, dizzy. But you will take much, much more from me before this is all done. I pace, fidget, impatient. My fingertips fray with the action of my teeth. Now that I am so close to what I want, my body feels more tired and shabby than ever. One morning, with you asleep for the day, I finally take out the mask again. I have been too preoccupied with you to look at it. I recognize a few ideograms right away, from textbooks or other digs, one meaning burnt, the other meaning pure or clean. I have to work at the rest, and the mask is too delicate to take a rubbing. I should open a curtain to let in more light, but that feels somehow risky, as if the sun will burn me, too. I find mention of the mask's holder or keeper, but nothing of a wearer. One figure stands out, though, significant, corded or bound. It becomes clear that the mask is more than just grave goods, but the language is opaque, ritualized, not meant to be understood by someone from this millennium. So my suspicions can only remain suspicions for now. Just to be sure, though, I lock it back in the hidden panel inside my hard-shell suitcase, securing it before I go to wake you. Your cataracts clear, your face fills out. I start to see how you must have looked in life. You are younger than I expected. I sit you down in the bathtub and clean away the dirt of 3,000 years with a washcloth and baby shampoo. I massage conditioner into your scalp. You press back into my fingers, eyes closed. Your hair grows to thigh length, then stops. Your bottom lip is full, so you appear to pout. As my body becomes thinner, yours grows languid, plump. Is this what you look like at the moment of your death? It must be. Though your throat is smoother and more golden every day, there is a red gash there, like a second mouth, refusing to knit. I know from when I unearthed you that whatever did this scored the bone. So even when you appear whole, pretty scarf, from a tourist shop covering your neck, you can only mouth words at me, throat straining, in a language I can neither hear nor understand. My chest tightens with a gnawing grief at your lost language, realizing I'll never hear you speak it. You are so hungry. It hurts me to admit that you need far more than I can give you. I do what you need me to do, of course. But I go about it angry, jealous. I make more of a mess than I should. After that, of course, we must leave. I'll get a passport made for you by someone I know in Athens. It's silly, but I take a photo with my phone just to make sure you'll show up. I set it as my lock screen, like we're a couple on vacation together. By the time I've locked up, I drop the key into the mail slot. You've already climbed into the driver's side of Christos's pickup. You buckle in, adjust mirror and seat back while I stand, frozen in the driveway, trying not to let you see how startled I am. I don't know what it means that you know how to drive a stick shift, a skill I have not taught you, a skill I don't even have. I had planned for us to walk to the village where there's an all-night car rental. I am tired, though. I let you drive, falling asleep, watching your eyes move in their sockets. The graceful economy of your soft arm turning the wheel. Your fingers curled around the tennis ball stuck on the head of the gear shift. I wake to suburbs. I'd been worried the city would frighten you, but you drink it in. Stripes of streetlight and neon painting your hungry face. I think you realize there will be more for you here. The thought sets my stomach fluttering. Athens is huge, dirty, loud, busy, even at night. It is crumbling and ancient and gorgeous. It suits you. You reach up to finger the glass Mati hanging from the rearview. You read exit signs and ease from the highway to a side street. Like you've driven this way before. I go cold. I remember Christos's body, lighter than a bundle of sticks in my arms. It rattled in its skin as I tipped it into the turned earth of the construction site. I had let you drain him completely. You were so hungry, and at the time, I couldn't see what harm it would do. Now I think through the implications, the possibilities. I wonder what else you've learned from Christos. My throat begins to itch with a familiar, restless want, like thirst. You are capable of such drama. I sleep in one night and wake to find you tearing up the hotel room. You're so wild, I don't immediately understand that you're looking for something. My suitcase is lying open in a corner, cloth lining shredded. My chest tightens, but the false panel is still intact. I breathe out slowly, trying not to look toward the suitcase. You turn to me and gesticulate, mouthing silently in your ancient language. Then you kneel. You beg. I know what you want. It is so close, I could give it to you with a glance in the right direction. But I keep still, my face a perfect blank, as if I do not understand. You fly at me, an inhuman incandescent malice, but your clawed hand stops just short of my eyes. I do not flinch. You've confirmed my suspicions. You cannot hurt me. You seem to realize it at the same time I do, and become docile again. As a treat, I take you out to eat. To be safe, we have to wait until very late, 3 or 4 in the morning. You fill out a gold lamé dress you've chosen for yourself, high-collared, of course. I'm gaunt and pale in the only suitable thing I own, a black cocktail dress I used to wear to conferences. I show you how to walk in high heels. We go to Exarchia, join a group of young men, drunk enough not to care who we are, to mind my accented Greek, your silence. As we'd hoped, one of them latches onto you. You catch my eye and drop back, letting him pull you into an alley. After a minute, I shout, "I'm going to check on my friend." No one notices me leave. The nameless boy is very drunk. He doesn't mind when your teeth sink into his neck. Maybe he thinks it's sexy. But as his face goes gray and he starts weakly to struggle, I remember the smooth action of your hand on the gear shift. I remember Christos. I wonder what this Greek boy knows that I don't. I reach between you and the lolling teenager and gently turn your face to mine. We can't kill anybody here. It's too dangerous. Your body tenses. The lamps of your hungry eyes fall on me, your mouth smeared black in the dark. For a moment, I think you'll see right through me, to the real reason I won't let you drain this boy. That you will try to hurt me again. But of course, you don't. I let you drink for me back at the hotel. And then it happens. I thought there'd be more fanfare somehow. But you simply pull away from me one evening and offer up your wrist. I take your hand, feel its weight. I need to make sure you are really doing this, that I'm not dreaming this moment. As I have 1,000 times before. I shudder all over. Touch my lips to the skin of your wrist. Peach soft. I look into your eyes and see resolution there. Determination. You are making this choice. And earlier than I had dared hope. Your blood is thick and bright and sweet. It flows like honey down my throat. I open myself to accept it. It runs down my chin and between my breasts into my lap. It tastes just as I knew it would. And when I can hold no more, you must drink it back from me. I knew this would come, have been craving this moment for 10 years. I'm not frightened. You must empty me completely so newness can fill me. A sigh escapes me. I give it all to you, no holding back anymore. I reach up to grasp your shoulders, but my arms are weak. You are so tender as you lay me down. It's quiet. I can't see. I'm not breathing, no pulse beating in my neck. The urge to fidget, to pace or chew my fingernails is gone. I have never felt my body completely at rest before. I wait for you to come to me, knowing I have all the time in the world. My body is so heavy. I'm hungry, thirsty. I know what I need. Just thinking about it starts up a want in me, deep and pulsing, just like I've wanted you all these years. I give myself to this sweet want for a while, soak in it. I move my head and something shifts. I drag my arm up and drop my hand onto my face, all the movement I can manage. My fingers meet familiar contours, the particular slick delicacy of beaten gold. The mask is much heavier than I remember. My fingers scrabble, instinctively trying to pull the mask off my face. But before I can hook a fingertip under it, my hand seizes, nerves on fire, like someone is bending my fingers back on themselves, pulling them out of their sockets. I have to drop my hand. I try to move, to feel around where I am, but raising my arm took all the strength I had. I stop, waiting for the pain to subside. I'm lying on a rough surface, stone. A breeze touches my neck, smelling of greenery, dust, and urine. Where am I? Where are you? I try to call out, Idomenea, but my voice is dead in my throat. I hear something, a car driving by. Wind rustling through leaves, distant bark of a dog. I can feel more than see the sky above me. Something else starts up, quiet but slowly gathering. A new sound. It's pretty, I think, before I understand what it means. All of a sudden, I know what you've done. Why you gave me what I wanted so readily. If I had the strength, would I weep or laugh? The sound is birdsong. It rises all around me with the dawn.
That was Eris Young's Idomeneja, or The Death Mask, as read by Michelle Kane. Michelle is from the Kansas City metropolitan area. She has a dulcimer and a bodhran that she doesn't have time to play because she spends her time working in a cube farm and being a mom to her son and their Labrador, and of course, narrating stories when she has the chance. She can be found on X at ShellDavis72. Thank you, Michelle.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Our second tale for tonight comes from Richard S. Crawford. Richard lives in an appropriately ancient and drafty house in Northern California with his wife and six nearly normal cats. You can find more about him at his website, underpope.com. Listen with me, children of the night, to Richard S. Crawford's Trying to Stay Dead, first published on the Halloween 2011 episode of Pseudopod.
Dr. Bell's assistant led me into the tiny exam room and gestured at the leather-padded chair in the center. "Are you ready to do this?" she asked, smiling. I hesitated. I'd been psyching myself up for an anamectomy for 2 months, but now the exam room gave me pause. It reminded me of a dentist's office. The chair in the center of the room sat benignly beneath a single circular lamp that could be moved and aimed in any direction, while beside it lurked a movable desk with a tiny computer and a single instrument that looked like a dentist's drill. "I suppose." "You're nervous, I can tell." The assistant wore a simple pink smock, the kind dental and mental hygienists all over the world wore. Her teeth gleamed an almost unnatural shade of white, and her silky brown hair cascaded lushly over her shoulders. She looked like a model. And why not? The tiny scar on her left temple and the ever-so-slightly unfocused look in her eyes told me she'd already had the snip. She acted happy and well-adjusted and was unaware of anything she or I were saying or doing. "A little," I replied. "I mean, I'm ready. Really, I am. It just seems weird. It's so final, you know?" "It's not weird at all." The name tag on her blouse read Sammy. "I had it done 3 years ago, and I'm sure I was as nervous as you. But it's so easy. You don't feel a thing. It looks scary, but all you do is just sit here. The doctor does his job, and snip, you're done." "You make it sound so simple." I tried to brave a smile, but felt clumsy. I sat down and tried to get comfortable. "You won't feel a thing." Sammy pressed me back gently against the chair, then leaned over me, giving me a generous show of perfect cleavage. She strapped me in, wrapping thick rubber straps around my legs, arms, and forehead. I was completely restrained. "That's just so you don't get surprised or jump or anything during the procedure," she explained. "There could be complications." I tried to nod, but I couldn't because of the band on my forehead. "I'm fine." Sammy stood up. "Okay, you're all ready. Dr. Bell will be with you in a moment." She left the room, and I watched her as she did so. Her ass was perfect. I closed my eyes and tried to relax. Maybe this was a stupid idea. Everyone I knew had gotten the snip, and they were all better people afterwards. Kinder, more thoughtful. They took better care of themselves. They got along better with everyone. And, unburdened with a sense of self, they were always smiling. But I couldn't help wondering if the snip wasn't just some sort of fancy lobotomy. Everyone who had had it done said it was painless. On the other hand, how would they know? There was a polite knock at the door, and it opened before I had the chance to respond. In stepped a gargantuan man, a leviathan in a white coat, who had to stoop a little just to avoid hitting his head on the lintel. His face was smooth, half obscured by a magnificently long, impeccably trimmed beard.
"Hello, Roger. I'm Dr. Bell. How are you?"
I tried to show him I was perfectly at ease by smiling as broadly as I could. "A little bit nervous," I told him.
"Oh, there's no cause for that. You won't feel a thing. I've performed this procedure close to 3,000 times.
Any fatalities?"
"None so far this week."
My heart froze solid in my chest. Dr. Bell must have seen it because he laughed.
No fatalities. Of course not. In fact, none of my patients have experienced any complications at all."
He sat down on a wheeled stool.
"Let's just get started here."
He turned a knob, and I felt a sharp pressure on my left temple.
"All right. Are you ready?"
I gasped as the pressure on my temple suddenly grew deeper, then terminated in a loud crunch.
"Let me snip."
"Think about it for a moment more," Roger says. But even before he finishes the sentence, the procedure is done. He blinks.
"Wow,"
he says. The doctor smiles at him.
"There, see? That wasn't so bad at all."
Roger looks around the room, a look of wonder on his face. He waves his hand in front of his face and repeats,
"Wow."
"You'll get used to it," Dr. Bell says.
He takes a small pad of paper out of his lab coat pocket and scribbles on it.
"I'm going to give you some post-surgical care instructions. There shouldn't be any problems, but we want you to stay fit and healthy, of course. Here."
He tears off the slip of paper and hands it over. Roger looks at it. The instructions are to exercise, eat healthy, sleep well, and be happy. Dr. Bell smiles.
"Think you can do that?"
"Of course," says Roger. "This looks easy."
"It will be."
Dr. Bell smiles one last time, gives Roger a friendly clap on the shoulder, and leaves the room. A moment later, Sammy returns. She unstraps Roger, helps him stand up, then gives him a big, friendly hug. Roger, smiling, returns it. He turns back to the desk and fills out the last of the paperwork. Then, still smiling, he leaves the office, looking like a man ready to start a new day and a new life. Roger spends his first few days after his procedure cleaning up his apartment. He has a lot of stuff. Nothing gets thrown away, but it all gets arranged carefully on shelves and in cubbies. He has hundreds of books and compact discs, as well as piles of magazines spread throughout the apartment. Between taking care of his body, cleaning up his apartment, and going to his job, he barely has time to spend with other people. On Friday night, his telephone rings. He picks it up and answers it.
"Hello, this is Roger."
A woman's voice squeals at him from the earpiece.
"Oh my God, Roger, it's Teresa! You've had the snip, haven't you? It's so obvious."
Roger nods. "It wasn't so bad. There really wasn't anything to it at all."
"Everyone knows that, Roger. You're so funny. Hey, you want to get together? Go on a date? Tonight? You've been attracted to me for a long time, but, well, you know."
Roger smiles. "Of course I would, Teresa. Nothing would make me happier."
"Great. I'll pick you up at your apartment in half an hour, okay? I know you're probably still getting used to things."
Teresa and Roger say their goodbyes. I hung up the phone and looked at it for a moment, happy to hear from Teresa, then goes to his bedroom to get ready. Dinner at the restaurant is well prepared, and the movie that Teresa takes Roger to is full of spectacle and music. He doesn't think about dinner during the movie, and after the movie, he doesn't reflect on it. But that's okay, because everything is good. He looks at Teresa with a smile, and then when she looks at him, he blushes and looks away. Teresa smiles. "Would you like to come back to my place?" I can feel my heart in my throat, and I said, "Sure." Then Roger shakes his head in momentary confusion.
"Are you okay?"
Teresa asks.
"Everything's fine," Roger says. "There was just a little..."
He pauses, then shrugs. His smile returns. Teresa shrugs.
"That happens sometimes," she says. "Sometimes after the snip there's some, well, some slipping. It's nothing to worry about. Come on, let's go."
She takes his hand. Roger follows, the smile never leaving his face. For a couple of weeks, things are great. Roger and Teresa meet just about every night, have dinner,
and go home to have sex. They talk about the things that couples talk about, the things they are expected to talk about, what they enjoy doing, their future together, and so on. They agree that if they have children, the children will have the snip done as early as possible. On a Thursday night, 2 weeks after Roger's procedure, Roger and Teresa have sex as usual. The smiles on their faces and the noises they make are high-pitched and full of laughter. But toward the end, Roger pauses, because I suddenly felt full of joy. I tried to ignore it. For a moment, I did, and Roger goes back to the task, but I couldn't keep it up. I withdrew from Teresa and lay down next to her. "Roger?" Teresa says. She leaned over me and gave me a kiss. "Are you all right?" I shook my head, trying to shake this thing out of me. I wasn't sure how to say it. "The snip didn't take," Teresa said. Roger smiles. "No, it's fine," he starts to say, but then I couldn't finish. She was right. It had been happening every now and then for almost a week now. I had been ignoring it, trying to deny it, but there was no more doing so. "I'm so sorry," Teresa says. I blinked and looked over at her. My heart sank. After the snip, everything had been so nice. No awareness, no doubts, nothing. But now it had worn off. I felt like a huge weight had been placed onto my chest. I struggled and tried to bring back the feeling that the snip had brought me. "Don't be sorry," Roger says, but the feeling only lasted for a moment. Teresa's eyes did not focus on me perfectly. I knew that behind them there was no consciousness, no animus, no sentience, no experience of qualia or sensation. Nothing but pre-existent behaviors and complex reflexes. A set of programs to give the illusion of personality and happiness. It was truly bliss. Roger tries to bring it back inside himself, but I wasn't able to. Not fully. "Go back to the doctor," Teresa said. "He can fix you again. Come and make love to me again." I tried, but it was hard, knowing that she was not experiencing any of it, only acting. It was better for me the first time around, when I didn't feel it and was unaware that it was happening. Sammy was just as beautiful as the first time I'd come in, but I was too depressed to give her more than a passing glance. She led me into Dr. Bell's office and gestured at the leather chair in front of the desk. "Sit down," she said. She smiled just as beautifully as the first time I'd seen her, white teeth flashing. And why shouldn't she? She had nothing at all to worry about. She was incapable of worry. "Dr. Bell will be in just a moment." She left the office and closed the door behind her. I looked around Dr. Bell's office. Everything here was in perfect order. Texts by Yablo, Chalmers, Blackwell, Nagel, and Kripke lined the bookshelves, all pioneers in the field of animectomological studies who had paved the way for further philosophical work and for the snip itself. Dr. Bell opened the door and stepped into the room.
"Well, hello, Roger. How are you?"
"Pretty miserable, doctor. The snip didn't take. I want to schedule another one." Sighing, Dr. Bell sat down behind his desk. He shook his head.
"I'm afraid that's not possible," he said. "Spontaneous reversal of the snip isn't unknown. We're still not sure how it happens. An ontological mutation to the essential phenomenological construct, we think, which causes a spontaneous reintegration of the internal experience of self. Some sort of Cartesian impairment, perhaps."
"Can you fix it?"
"I'm afraid not. Phenomenological deconstructs, hindered by ontological deformations, are notoriously difficult to treat. The best experimental philosophers have struggled with the problem, but all attempts to establish a full physiological denial of the self-experience have failed. No matter what we do, the self always returns." I hadn't understood a single word of what he said.
"What?"
Dr. Bell smiled condescendingly. "In brief, no. Every once in a great while, the snip restores itself spontaneously, and in those cases only partially, but I wouldn't count on that." I sank down into my chair. "Don't worry. Many people have gone on to live full and complete lives, despite being burdened with an awareness of self. I can recommend a series of exercises and techniques to help you overcome it. With time and patience, you may find that you can experience brief periods of, "No," I said, "I'm not interested. If I can't have the real thing, I don't want it at all." "Very well," Dr. Bell said, looking directly at me. "Then there isn't anything else I can do for you?" I shook my head. Every part of my body felt heavy, as if made of stone. Still, I forced myself to stand up. "Thanks for everything," I said. He waved at me, and I left. I tried to get together with Teresa once more, because it seemed like her presence helped me just a bit to recover the senselessness that I'd felt just after the snip, but I couldn't. She was sweet, but there was just something there that she and I couldn't be part of together. I broke things off with her, and she cried, but felt no sadness. She acted sad, with tears and a runny nose, but inside, I knew, there was nothing at all. I could, at least, console myself with that knowledge, even if it would never be true for me. She was a beautiful woman. I knew it wouldn't take long for another snipped man to find her. And even if none ever did, she would never be unhappy. I let my own life fall to pieces. Overpowered by my sense of self, I gave up on eating well, exercising, on sleeping. I gained back the weight I had lost. Blemishes appeared on my face. I tried to keep up with my job, but I kept getting distracted by things I felt, things I became aware of, such as my own thoughts and feelings. After a while, I just gave up. Everyone else in the office had had the snip, and they all seemed so happy. None of them could share my burden. I felt nauseous. Finally, I could take it no more. I went to the edge of town on a Wednesday night, to where the Emperor Norton Bridge connected San Augustine with the other side of the bay. I drove halfway across the bridge, then got out of my car and stood at the edge, leaning over the railing and looking down at the water. "Hey there," said a voice to my right. I turned. A young woman, hair red like fire and wearing a simple white dress, stood on the edge of the bridge, just a few feet to my right. Her bare toes dangled precariously, but she seemed to maintain her balance with no effort. Her left temple was smooth and unscarred, and she looked directly at me. "Are you going to jump?" she asked. "That's the plan." "Why?" I sighed. How could I possibly explain myself? It's a long story. She peered at me, her eyes boring directly into mine. "The snip didn't take, did it?" "No, it didn't." "And so you're here about to kill yourself?" "It's the agony of being," I blurted out, unable to contain myself. "I just wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to be able to not care, to just ignore everything and not worry about anything." "Oh," she said. "Well, that's perfectly reasonable." "Yeah, I've had a taste of the emptiness, the state of non-being, while still being here. I can't take this constant awareness of myself, especially knowing that everyone else around me is unburdened with it." I hadn't realized it, but my voice was actually getting louder as I spoke. I took a breath to calm myself. For a moment, the two of us stood in perfect silence, letting the wind blow over us. "Wow," she breathed at last. "What magnificent bullshit." "I beg your pardon?" "Oh, nothing. I mean, I've heard some real lame excuses to commit suicide before, but that was one of the worst. You should have thrown in an unrequited love, a crushing debt, or at least a dead puppy." "Agony of being?" she scoffed. "Pathetic." "Well, what about you? What's your excuse?" "For what?" "For killing yourself." "I'm not." "Then why are you here?" She smiled. "I'm just here to enjoy the night air. Isn't it wonderful?" "Whatever. Just go about your business, all right? Pretend I'm not here." "Fuck her," I thought. I stepped over the railing and looked out over the ocean. The water down there was awfully choppy and looked very cold. Of all bridges in California, the Emperor Norton Bridge had the lowest suicide survival rate, and the city had done nothing about it, aside from plastering a few flyers with the number of a local suicide hotline. The woman yawned loudly.
"You gonna take all night?"
"Fuck you," I said. I said it to the woman on the bridge,
I said it to the bridge. I said it to the ocean, to the cities on either side of the bridge. I said it to the world, to God, to Dr. Bell, to Teresa and Sammy, to mutagenic phenomenologies. I said it to my brain. I said it to a universe which wouldn't allow me to let go of myself and which made me hang on to a consciousness that I never asked for and never wanted. Fuck you, I repeated. Then I said it again, just for good measure. Fuck you. She stared. Please don't do it, she said. Annoyed, I let go of the railing and took a step out over the open water. Then, before I could have a chance to back out, I took another, and then I was falling. I heard the girl screaming behind me. I'm not sure what I expected. The wind rushed past my ears and onto my face. The way my hair flew around myself and the freshness of the salty air were exhilarating. I closed my eyes and savored the moment, then opened my eyes and looked down. The water rushed up to me with a malignant solidity I would never have been able to foresee. My heart leapt in my chest. This was the wrong idea. Snip! You say aloud, and then your body slams into the water, and you stop. But it's not the end. You survive, but just barely. Your internal organs are damaged. Your hip is broken and refuses to heal. You live in a chair. Teresa comes to visit you from time to time, but never stays for long. She is sympathetic to your situation, but finds you too self-involved, and eventually stops showing up altogether. The girl from the bridge also comes to visit you sometimes as well. She, too, is sympathetic, but she finds you too distant. In the end, it's just you, and despite the constant pain, you are almost happy.
That was Richard S. Crawford's Trying to Stay Dead, as read by Jesse Holt. Little is known about Jesse Holt, though rumors have circulated that he was found frozen within a 20,000-year-old ice formation during an Arctic oil drilling expedition. This is purely speculation, of course, as the official records state that the entire staff of the camp perished in what was described at the time as the most savage polar bear attack in history, judging by the mutilated and partially consumed corpses that littered the snow. Strangely, no bear tracks were found. Today, Jesse is a voice actor and tour guide with a passion for travel. And he's always happy to meet new victims, friends. You can find him on X at Jesse Holt Voice or on his website at jesseholtvoice.com. Thank you, Jesse.
Well, children of the night, the hour is late, and we've run out of tales to tell. For now. Tales to Terrify is made possible by the tremendous generosity of our supporters on Patreon and PayPal. Incredible fans like Lessel Baxter, Paul Belcher, Amanda Carrillo, Amanda Gottfried, and Orion D. Higra, whose generous support helps keep the lights on and flickering ominously. Not a supporter already? Head over to patreon.com/talestoterrify, where you'll find all kinds of perks, like ad-free episodes, bonus content, and one-of-a-kind collectibles and merch packs. Every dollar goes back into this show to make it as horrific as possible, and we appreciate it so much. Want another way to support the show that doesn't cost a cent? Head over to Podchaser, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating or review. You'll not only put an unnaturally wide smile on our faces, but help new listeners discover our terrifying tales, too. Why not share your love of the show out in the world with some Tales to Terrify merch? TalesToTerrify.com/merch will take you to our TeePublic store, where we've got a great collection of creepy custom and curated designs, so you can show those around you just how twisted you truly are. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Meredith Morgenstern, Andrew Gibson, Crystal Hammond, Spencer Disparti, and myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Join us again next week as we plumb the inky depths for more Tales to Terrify.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.